The global economy is vast and complex, but when countries do decide that they have an alignment of interests and decide to partner up, they can have very powerful effects, both on the global economy as a whole, but also from a strategic perspective.
You're listening to the USSC Briefing Room, a podcast from the United States Study Center at the University of Sydney, where we give you a seat at the table for a USSC briefing on the latest developments in US news and foreign policy. We'll cover what you need to know and what's beneath the surface of the news.
Hello, I'm Hayley Channer, Director of the Economic Security Program at the United States Study Center. Today we're recording in two separate places, on the land of the Gadigal people in Sydney and also on the land of the Ngunnawal people in Canberra. We acknowledge them as the traditional custodians and owners of the land, and I pay my respects to their elders past and present. And to draw out an economic angle, Indigenous people were this country's very first international traders, trading with people in Indonesia. I'm recording today with Helen Mitchell. Helen is the inaugural non-resident fellow with USSC's Economic Security Program. She is a Sir Roland Wilson Scholar at the Australian National University, where she's undertaking a PhD on Australian economic security. Helen has previously worked as an economist, diplomat, and in senior advisory roles in the Australian government, including at the Treasury and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Helen's just authored a new report, Unlocking Economic Security, a Strategic Playbook for Australia, which dives deep into the central questions of economic security facing Australian policymakers.
So what is it about economic security that is difficult to achieve, and why do we need to go after it?
Great question. The first thing I should say up front is that it's always good to have a catchy title for your interesting report that you've put lots of research into and collaborated a lot with great colleagues on. So certainly it sounds like it's hitting the mark in terms of whetting your appetite to know more about unlocking economic security and how we can do that.
Yeah, the first hurdle is getting people to open it, isn't it?
It really is. So the other part of it, the serious part of it, is about the motivation for the report was about the big picture reality that Australia and other countries are facing, which is a more competitive global environment and plenty of shared challenges alongside that. So things like climate change and inequality, other forces basically that shape the international system that we live in, that can have difficult outcomes and consequences for us here in Australia and in other parts of the world as well. So these forces, this competition, sort of strategic competition in the global environment, these shared challenges, they interact with each other. And overall, what it means for Australian policymakers is they're having to deal with more complexity, more competition, and everything's happening faster. So it's sped up. And my motivation from that, sort of taking the economic slice of that big picture of what's happening in the system, the global system at the moment, is that for Australia, these forces are shaping the global economy and other parts of the world as well, things like military competitions being shaped by all those forces as well. And in that economic domain, I realised that there was a reason to look at economic security, both to understand what it is and what we can do to respond to it, to actually get out ahead in some cases of these forces, and to fit that economic slice of what's going on in the world in context. So to see the economic part as interacting with and helping to shape not just the global economy, but also how Australia and others use their other tools of what's commonly called statecraft. So the other tools being things like military tools or information or diplomatic tools. That was the motivation for my report, is look at the economic slice of that and how that can complement what Australia is doing in other areas, and to respond to and actually get out in front of what's happening in our world.
It really seems like that's the way that countries are going all over the world, because the United States has got its industrial policy, and other countries in Europe or Japan, Korea, they're also looking at this question of economic security, whether you call it that or geoeconomics or economic statecraft, it does mean different things to different countries a little bit, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I do agree. And to kind of try to help us tackle that question of what is economic security, I started basically with trying to make a catalogue of what are the economic security tools, what are the policies, what are the things that governments are doing in the economic security space. There was good reason to dig into that because I was seeing economic security, or sometimes what you've also mentioned can be called geoeconomics, or sometimes economic statecraft. I was seeing these terms pop up in relation to lots of different types of tools that were being used by governments around the world. So, for example, economic security could cover things like what the US was doing in terms of its industrial policy, or in terms of the export controls it was using to try and block technology transfer of advanced semiconductors to China. That term was also being used to describe what Australia experienced when China, for example, stopped importing some of our products, things like our wine and our lobsters. That term was also being used to describe things like energy security. So countries thinking about, you know, in the event of a crisis, what would we do to shore up our, you know, stockpiles of energy? What would we do to ensure that we could keep receiving imports, or in some cases send out exports of energy? And that term was also being used closer to Australia's home when talking about things like infrastructure investments that were happening in the Pacific. People were talking a lot about things like China coming in and doing these big infrastructure investment projects and talking about problems associated with that, problems like debt levels or social problems happening close to the, within the communities where those infrastructure projects were happening. So I kept seeing this term come up over and over again, and it seemed to describe on the face of it quite different situations. And it felt like an area of opportunity to actually think logically, basically apply some first principles logic to what is the problem that we're trying to solve here. And then linking back to what I said about the motivation for the report and the research I've done behind that, and what does that mean for where we sit in the world and the bigger picture reality that we're facing now and that's coming down the pipeline in the future. So to do that, I started zooming in on one of these economic tools and policies people use. I've just mentioned a couple of examples. And what I do in the report, the economic security report, is I link a thread through all these different types of policies. And I note along the way, as I'm linking these policies together, that these policies have, of course, economic effects, but they're also doing things like they're signaling countries' intent, or they're contributing to countries' efforts to deter others against doing what they don't want them to do, or they're doing things like dialing up the pressure on policymakers in another country. They're also doing things that are both economic and strategic, things like wanting to push ahead their firms and their industries and their country ahead of others. So by looking at the tools and linking that thread between the policies, I came up with this definition of economic security. And that definition is that it's about how countries manage both the opportunities of global economic connections, but it's also about how they manage the risks of those connections as well. And the way I define those global economic connections that countries are managing is about these flows of resources between countries. And resources, traditionally in the economic literature at least, used to mean things like flows of people between countries, flows of labor. It definitely always meant things like flows of goods. It meant things, so, you know, Australia, for example, early in Federation, one of the things that we used to export a lot was, you know, wool, for example. And as we know today, Australia is a major export in commodity markets. We're also now a services exporter. So apart from the sort of traditional flows of resources, things like goods and people, I expand that definition to help us understand economic security today. And I talk about global resource flows as not just being goods and people. It's also about flows of money. It's about flows of services that can happen a bit like we're recording this podcast today, Hayley. Things can happen. We can provide services.
Ideas. We're exchanging ideas, right? And
indeed,
that's another commodity.
That's right. So that's another resource flow I talk about, is also flows of information and ideas as well. and combinations of those. So that's actually not a simple part of the definition, but the overall definition itself is fairly straightforward. It's about countries managing the risks and opportunities of all those flows of resources that go across their borders, whether it's physically or, in our case, as we're doing right now, sort of virtually across state borders. And the context I put that in is that the world today is interconnected. So global markets are often vast and deep. There's a lot of talk these days, for example, during the pandemic, we really thought a lot more than we used to about complex global supply chains. We thought a lot about the fact that we don't always know when a product, especially a complex manufactured product, arrives on our doorstep. We don't always know, and the firms themselves, by the way, that are involved in supply chains don't always know exactly where all the parts for that product were made.
Yeah.
Where did some of the ideas or the intellectual property that's in that product come from? And so on and so on. So that's the interconnected part of the definition, is the fact that what we have to face is this reality that we're very connected as countries. There are some exceptions to that in the world. I mean, North Korea springs to mind. It doesn't have as many global connections as other countries, but certainly Australia does. And the other thing about the world that I mentioned in my economic security definition is that it's interconnected and it can also be dangerous. And I mention that because that really brings in the geopolitical or the political element of economic security, which is that countries can often have, you know, strong, peaceful relationships, but there's always the possibility that relationships break down or that tensions bubble up. For some countries, having really violent even tensions with your neighbours is actually just an everyday reality. The Australian perspective has been different for a while, at least speaking from an international perspective. But lots of countries deal with that on a daily basis. They wouldn't be shocked by that part of the definition. But I do bring that out in this report because it's important to understand that these economic tools and policies that I'm talking about, they can be used also in recognition of the fact that sometimes we're trying to make the world less dangerous through the use of these economic tools. So by that, I mean, sometimes you're doing things to undergird peaceful relationships. You might decide to sign a trade agreement with a country that you really want to reinforce positive relationships with. You really want to see economic benefits for both sides. And sometimes you might use things like an export control. That's when you can block transfer of goods or technology from one country to another. And countries like the US are sometimes doing things like that because they're trying to deter other countries from progressing in certain military capabilities, for example. So that's the definition.
I really love your definition because I find it very effective in explaining what's changed. So if you think about the end of World War II, we had the Bretton Woods system and the US created this system whereby free trade and lower tariffs and lower trade barriers meant that we could trade freely. Now the tables have really turned and we're looking at a world where it's not just goods and services that are considered strategic or of a security value. It is also those other things, the intangible things that we wouldn't have necessarily considered before. And I think we even do see this playing out in the tech space in terms of this ongoing public debate in the US and Australia more about TikTok and how China has also banned things like WhatsApp. So you do really see this competition spilling over into the economic realm, but I love how you talk about managing the opportunities and risks from the global flow of resources. But it does also make me think about how economic security can be ubiquitous or it can become like national security. You know, everything has a monetary value in some way, but your report really does help provide a framework for that. And it provides this toolkit for policymakers. The next thing I wanted to ask you is really about this playbook for evaluating economic security policies and the tools that governments have to use to their advantage. So obviously, if you're Australia compared to the US or China, each of those three different countries have different tools. And in your report, you also take a historical view of things. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I start to understand the playbook. It all hinges on this definition. So I'll just state that again. I describe economic security policies as being about how the state decides to manage the risks and the opportunities of global flows of resources, goods, services, people, money, information, and ideas in an interconnected and dangerous world. So it hinges on that definition. When you define economic security that way, it really reveals that there's a range of economic levers that governments can use anywhere in the world. That fundamental definition is universal. And when you define economic security that way, there are different tools or levers that countries can use to try and shape those global flows of resources. This is where a little bit of the economics comes in. As something that's a little bit different about the research I do and the report I've written is that it's an interdisciplinary approach. So it's to say that the geopolitics is really important for understanding what's motivating countries to use these tools and to understand the kind of geopolitical effects that they can have. But there's an economic element there too, because the global economy does work by the laws of economics. And it's good to understand as well the economic slice of that, the inner economic logic of how these tools work, because that will have economic effects, but also the way they work in an economic way can have strategic effects. So, for example, I talk about there being two types, essentially, of tools that governments can use in their economic security toolkit. They have tools or incentives which can incentivize more flows of global resources between countries, and they also have tools that can incentivize less, reduce, sometimes even completely cut off global flows of resources.
Turning on or turning off the tap, isn't it?
Yes, and dialing up and down would be the way I would say it. It's rare, apart from that North Korea example I gave before, it's quite rare to see countries actually try to completely turn off a particular flow of resources. Usually what governments today are trying to do is incentivize a bit more of some or a bit less of others in particular sectors or areas, depending on what their goals are. And a point I make early on in the report as well is that, of course, when governments use economic incentives and levers, as they've been doing for a very long time, they're often trying to do a range of things. Sometimes they're trying to do very domestic-focused things, like they might be trying to reduce unemployment. Sometimes they might be doing things with a mix of motives in mind. They might be trying to put particular industries out ahead of others in the global competitive environment. They might be trying to solve market externalities. I'm thinking here, for example, of the US's Inflation Reduction Act, where they're trying to do lots of things at once. Some of it's environmental goals, some of it's domestic goals, some of it is about global competition in an economic and a strategic sense. So the sort of carrots and the sticks is how I describe them, the carrots being things that encourage more resource flows and the sticks do the opposite. And carrots, therefore, include things like free trade agreements or scholarships, temporary labour mobility programs. In the Australian context, that would be something like the PALM program, for example. Sticks are the opposite side. So that's things like you might use, the US often uses sanctions. Australia experienced, for example, China's bans on our imports. Things like export controls that Australia's used for a long time on sensitive technology, or things like travel bans. That can be a good way to think about the sticks in your mind. You know, a travel ban is usually targeted at a certain person or group, you know, and that's a range of measure to say, you know, you can't cross borders, you can't enter a country. That's really the stick part of trying to cut off resource flows. So to get back to the playbook, what I point out in the report is that these policies that alter economic incentives have economic but also strategic, environmental, it can even have demographic effects. It can change incentives for the way people want to move between countries. And some of the effects of these economic tools can actually increase pressure on policymakers in other countries, and they can do really important things from a geopolitical perspective. They can do things like signal intent. They can signal a country's credibility in a certain area. They can encourage a reallocation of resources. So in the report, I use the example of US export controls and also industrial policy measures and things like research incentives in the area of advanced semiconductor chips. And in that case, what I look at in the report is how the US has used its playbook, so its mix of carrots and sticks, to do a lot of things. So this is more of a concrete example of what I was just talking about. They're trying to do economic things. They're trying to boost prosperity. They're trying to do domestic things in the US, like create jobs by starting up some advanced semiconductor ecosystems onshore. But they're also trying to do some strategic things. You know, they're looking at trying to reduce reliance on one particular global economic choke point. That's in Taiwan for advanced semiconductors. And they're also trying to do things like signal their intent and credibility with respect to China. So they're doing things like they're basically dialing up the pressure, certainly the resources pressure on Chinese policymakers by attempting to deny them access to these advanced semiconductor chips that China's government could use or could funnel into business to do things like fuel industrial expansion in areas that the US is worried about from a military and a capability perspective. So lots of things going on there, but that's one example of the tools that governments have in their own toolkits, which will be individual to each country. So each country will have different things that are palatable domestically. So for example, in the US at the moment, it's probably popular to do things, mostly popular, to do things like startup manufacturing onshore. That can be good from a political perspective, but it might be, there might be less domestic appetite to do things like sign free trade agreements. I mentioned that in the report as well. And that will be different, for example, in somewhere like China, where the sort of the domestic contract, I guess, that the government has there, the state contract with its people looks different. It's different to Australia, where we're also trying to do different things. And each country as well, they might have certain strategic alignments. I mean, for example, Australia continues to be a very close ally of the United States. But that doesn't mean, for example, that our global economic interests are exactly aligned. You know,
no, we have totally different economies, don't we?
Yes. And that's a key thing I point out in the report. So this, I use the word endowments. It's sort of the way economists tend to think about these things. But each country as well is set up with a different set of endowments. Some countries have abundant natural resources that are great for export. Others, you know, their big capability might be a really vast, large labor force with competitive wages. That's sort of basic economic trade theory. That's getting back to comparative advantage. But that factors into the playbook too. There are things that really big countries like the United States can do that no one else can do. They have the ability, if they really want to be a fairly self-sufficient economy, for example. They, in recent decades, have done things like really shored up their energy security by promoting different types of energy sources onshore. I'm thinking there about fracking, for example. And that's not available to every other country. And that makes the playbook look different to each country as well. But that fundamental idea that it comes back to, the definition of what economic security itself is and the types of tools you can use, that's universal. You just have to layer on each country's situation.
I keep thinking about how your report is so well timed, because we're having all of these discussions right now in the public sphere. Even when you talk about energy security, which is related to economic security, because who controls energy and the sources of different energy really does matter, because that's a flow of goods. I think about how Australia is talking about its renewable energy transition. And obviously that's what the US Inflation Reduction Act is primarily targeted at. And also, like you point out, Helen, the policy itself is so complex. It's not just one thing. I think the IRA even includes health aspects to it. And I know President Biden himself complained that it shouldn't have been called the Inflation Reduction Act. It doesn't really mean anything to anyone, but that's all about domestic politics for you. It's so fascinating, all of these different elements that come in to have to come together to create more national security in this more contested world. So the next question I will have for you is to get right into this framework that you provide, because what I love about your report is that it provides solutions. It doesn't just admire the problem or explain the definitions, it also gives solutions. And the one that you have come up with is an approach called Scan, Share, Shape. Can you please explain that approach?
Thank you, first of all. The Scan, Share, Shape ecosystem is not actually new. I know that it's not to say that the
report doesn't have lots of new ideas. You should just say you have created this new approach.
for better or for worse, the alliterative part is all my own. So I have to take all the blame for
all the credit.
Sort of a three-part alliterative system. You know, the idea being that it helps people remember.
Hey, slip, better. Slop, slap was very effective and also good for your health. So
I think that subliminal messaging, it sounds like, really resonated with me. So the ecosystem that I describe in the report is not the new part. The new part is suggesting using my broad definition of economic security, which is those risks and opportunities of those global resource flows in an interconnected and dangerous world. And the other bits that are new are that joined up policymaking, which I talk about in Scan Chair Shape, is already happening, especially in high levels of government in Australia. I suggest in the report that more sharing of insights, actually a bit further down the chain, what we would call in government the sort of the working level, will help Australia achieve its goals more flexibly. And I also point to really expanding data and analysis capabilities in line with the definition of economic security I give to make us more flexible. And coming back to what we talked about at the top, the bit about unlocking economic security, the bit that's new here that I think we need to work on, the opportunity that's there, is about being able to respond as quickly and as flexibly and as proactively as possible to that environment I mentioned. So the bit that's also new about the Scan Share Shape environment is the pace at which I think the Australian government can work at, that we need to work at to respond to that environment. So getting actually into what the three S's are, I talk about how governments in lots of different parts of government already do quite a lot of scanning of the economic security environment. Scanning means doing things like identifying paths towards desired economic security outcomes. That might be, you might be thinking about, I really want to make sure Australia is an energy secure country. What are the different policy tools and levers I can use to get there? It also means, going back to that definition, thinking about risks. So it also means looking for off-ramps to potentially undesired futures. So using energy security again, you might be worried about in a crisis scenario, what would we do about our energy security if we thought that some important sources of energy were going to get cut off? So that's the scanning. The bit that's new there, because lots of that already happens, the bit that's new there is that I talk about thinking about joining up that scanning with a really broad view of what economic security is, risks and opportunities, and combining lots of parts of government reasonably early on in the policymaking chain of activities. Multi-agency connection points is one model I point to in the report. There could be others and ways to do that. The benefit of doing that and doing more of it is really that you can come up with reports and policy options early on to present to your high-level policymakers. So, for example, things in the Australian system, because as you know, we're Westminster, would usually go up to things like the Secretary's Committee of National Security and go up eventually to the National Security Committee of Cabinet. So the benefit of doing things earlier on in a flexible and holistic way is just that the rich smorgasbord of options you're going to pass up to the high-level policymakers.
I like that, the smorgasbord for them to choose from.
Yes, it will be richer. So businesses do this a lot these days. It's partly to do with complex systems thinking, which has become, for good reason, really popular among businesses dealing in complex systems, things like the global economy. And it also has to do with this global competitive environment we're facing and basically needing to do better and faster. So that's the sort of scanning environment. And in the report, I highlight that something that's also new that we could do more of is analysis and data capabilities. So centralizing more data on global resource flows, both now and in the future, what that could look like, and then analyzing that. So for example, Australia already has the Office of Supply Chain Resilience that's looking at supply chain vulnerabilities. And with the definition I give of economic security, it suggests that we could do that, but also think about opportunities as well. And think about it from a holistic perspective.
And just before you go on to the share and shape parts of the framework, I just wanted to reflect on the point you make about interagency coordination, because like you made the point before, this is an sort of intersectional challenge. And unless you have cooperation between multiple agencies, you will not get the solution you need. And it's not like we're like Japan, which has a Minister for Economic Security. There is no Australian government agency dedicated to solving this problem. And sometimes when you have no one in charge, then no one feels that they have responsibility for it, which is why it's so important to have at least a coordination mechanism like you suggest.
I think that's right. There are great diagrams that the USSC team devised in this report that show two examples of where they do this kind of joined up economic security policy making with dedicated teams in bigger countries than ours, to be fair. So in the US, which is a very big country, and Japan, which is big as well. And when you look at those pictures in the report, what you see is that they really ensure that at an early level in the policymaking process, lots of different diverse types of departments. So, for example, in Japan's case, you've got ideas coming up from Japan's External Trade Organization, its International Cooperation Agency, its Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Finance, its Ministry of Defense and Justice and others. They're able to sort of coalesce early on in the policymaking stage and think about what economic security policies mean, not just for Japan's economy, which is important, but what are all the connecting, linking effects from a strategic perspective, from a legal perspective, environmental and so on. So I do, that's right, I do point out in the report that there are models out there that we could consider that might help Australia increase its agility, increase the pace at which it's able to both respond to events happening in the world, but also be proactive about opportunities that we see. So that's the scanning part. On the sharing part of the ecosystem, this is about things that already happen with government, and it's just about suggesting more sharing. Really what I get to hear is that there are lots of insights and expertise out there that we need to understand economic security. So some of those insights and information and data lies with the business community. Some of it lies with communities, for example, that might be grappling with thoughts about there's this big clean energy transition going on. What's going to happen to our community that might be quite reliant on fossil fuel industries? The sharing part of the picture is saying that government already does and could do lots more of that sharing of insights and information from the government side about what's potentially coming down the pipeline, what's happening in the international environment that people need to know about, and going the other way as well, wanting to find out from business and community groups what's top of their mind. So partly that enriches the government's set of data, partly that helps prepare people and communities for what's going on in government and what could be happening. Part of that is developing that social license for the sort of economic security policies that governments might be considering in the future. I don't have one particularly in mind, but that's always a part of it. And a big part of it as well is actually bringing in more people. I'm thinking here about the research and academic community, bringing in more people into those economic security conversations. So really what I was responding to there is noticing, especially as I moved into the think tank community and the research community, was noticing that there are some groups in Australia that have really strong capabilities in terms of geopolitical risk, understanding economic security. I'm thinking here about very big business groups that tend to have their own in-house economic security capabilities.
Absolutely.
To me, that contrasted vastly with the experience of very small business owners.
Yes, you can't afford it.
That's exactly right. And perhaps also didn't see the need and what benefit they would get out of it. Also noticing amongst members of the community that perhaps we're going to be affected by economic security policies. In this case, I am thinking of a concrete example. As I mentioned earlier, I'm thinking about communities that could be affected by transitions to a different type of energy system in Australia and in our region. And thinking about this as part of a broader debate we have in Australia about how to support those communities in transition. So that sharing piece already happens, and I just say in the report, more of that is going to be really beneficial for our data and analysis capabilities, and certainly for the social license piece. I think too that that's where I really started thinking about the domestic facet of economic security. So for example, in that clean energy transition example, I realized that economic security is also deeply linked to the resilience of Australian workers and our economy. And that hinges on things like having open markets. That's what we saw, for example, with the case of facing China's bans on our imports. We saw that having an open economy was really important to divert some of our resources and to, so in some cases, to be fair, we were getting lower prices for our products, but nevertheless still being able to sell. And just as a buffer for any kind of big crisis and shock that comes up, whether it's something like an import ban from another country, whether it's another pandemic, those open borders are really critical. But then on the Australian workers' piece of resilience, I realised that another big part of the economic security agenda was also about how we manage changes in jobs and employment opportunities and in the way we work for Australian workers. That's also part of having a secure economy. So training and skills, we've seen in other big transitions that we've faced in the world that if you don't bring workers along, so if people can't transition to other jobs, it's absolutely devastating. So I bring that into the economic security agenda as well, talking about the productivity, the policies Australia needs to boost its productivity, which will also boost our economic capabilities, and ensuring that research incentives and skills and training are there to help people transition as well.
Just on that, I mean, the point you make couldn't be better put, because if you look at what's happening in the United States, a lot of no-collar workers were left behind when the US did trade deals, or at least that's the perception, even though those free trade deals did help the United States economy overall. Those workers felt left behind. They felt like their jobs went to other countries and they weren't given the skills and training needed to transition them into the new industries that they would be working in. And that's why you see such a backlash against free trade in the United States. So yeah, in the Australian context, we are also going to have to battle with this transition of the workforce, whether that's in terms of the clean energy or even in shipbuilding. I think about all of the shipbuilding needs, but who wants to go into shipbuilding? You know, is that a career of the future? And also even thinking about mining, I mean, for the clean energy transition, we need more miners to mine the critical minerals that go into clean technologies. But young people do not think about mining as a job of the future. So yeah, that's so fascinating. Helen, question without notice to you. I actually wanted to ask about how recently you made a trip to South America for your PhD. And I want to ask you why. Why did you go to South America? What was the purpose? Because that might not be something that people would think about in terms of economic security.
Well, first of all, spot on about your point on transitions and what that can mean for people and industries if it's not managed well. So I say in the report that we should seize an economic security asset, things like our social safety net, the support systems we have that can help people transition. On your question without notice, well, it's a great question. Why would I go to South America to do economic security research? I guess a bit like the sort of the statecraft perspective I'm describing, a mix of motives there. The big reason for me was I saw basically an outlier. So this is a research perspective. It's interesting sometimes to study outliers. It can tell you a lot about what can happen in the future. It can tell you a lot about why a country is doing something that's considered very unusual. The outlier was the country of Paraguay, which sits in the heart of South America. I'm assuming maybe that you haven't been.
I have never been there.
So imagine a fairly small, heart-shaped, landlocked country in the middle of South America.
And you're making it sound very romantic, actually. Now it sounds like full of intrigue.
Yes, yes. Well, it's a great country to visit, and they're looking to boost their tourism. So I guess I'm also thinking from that perspective for them. And the thing that's interesting about Paraguay, from my perspective, is that it is Taiwan's last diplomatic partner in South America. So Taiwan still has diplomatic partners around the world. This is countries that they have formal diplomatic relations with. But it's getting increasingly hard to find countries that have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. That goes back, it's a long history between China and Taiwan, as we know, but basically following the civil war in China, there was a rule that China imposed, which was that countries had to choose whether or not to have diplomatic relations with either China or Taiwan. They couldn't have both. And over time, for lots of reasons over time, countries have tended to choose China over Taiwan. That's been the overwhelming trend in the decades since 1949.
There's only about five countries or something left, like a handful of countries, one in the Pacific, I think the Vatican.
Yes, the Vatican is one of them. More than that, actually. So we're around a dozen. But you're right to say, so Nauru in our region in the Pacific recently shifted, but there are still two diplomatic partners left in the Pacific for China. So I was interested in one of these outlier countries that still recognises Taiwan. Why? What's going on there? What is this close relationship? And partly it was because on face value, Paraguay is a small country, as I said, in the heart of South America. And it's actually what's called the antipode. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
That's correct. Yep.
Yes, thank you. The antipode to Taiwan. So if you thought about the globe and you sort of, if you had a sort of a plastic ball and you sort of stuck a skewer through, you would get from Taiwan on one side almost to Paraguay on the other. So what sort of on earth is undergirding that relationship? And I wanted to know what the economic slice of that was. And look, I mean, that's sort of research that's yet to be published, but the economic slice is very important. And I'm also discovering with that story that it's a story of partnerships. And that really links back to Australian interests these days in global partnerships, because something that I mentioned in this report is that the global economy is vast and complex. But when countries do decide that they have an alignment of interests and decide to partner up, they can have very powerful effects, both on the global economy as a whole, but also from a strategic perspective. So I'm thinking here, for example, about when countries decide to do things like share data and share capabilities, or when they decide to actually commit to rules like free trade, for example, at the World Trade Organization. These can have mammoth effects in both an economic and strategic perspective, but it does depend on managing what can be relationships with competing incentives and different interests. It does require a lot of communication. So that's certainly a big part of the diplomatic statecraft piece. But to finish on Paraguay, I really learned there that even though China, for example, has very powerful economic tools at its disposal, that doesn't always get you all the time exactly what you might want, in this case, China wanting to have a diplomatic relationship with Paraguay. So there is real cause for thinking both about partnerships and about economic tools alongside these other tools that I mentioned, things like diplomatic tools of statecraft, sometimes military tools are appropriate to actually, in Paraguay's case, push on with the relationship that it wants and the commitment that it wants to Taiwan.
There's so much pressure on smaller developing countries, I guess, to choose because the opportunities can be limited. And sometimes when they choose one country, they're saying no to another. It does increase the tensions, which is such a shame because it's a shame to see development assistance become politicized, but that is just the world we're living in. Okay, Helen, every podcast we like to finish with a by the numbers. So do you have a stat or a figure that you'd like to talk about in relation to your report or just generally?
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to be just a little bit cheeky.
Please do.
So I might actually, if you don't mind, give two numbers. I do like numbers, and they are close to my heart.
You are an economist.
Yes, I can't avoid that. Although I will say I did manage in this report I didn't use any charts. So if anyone out there is not a chart lover.
Well, you're disappointing all the economists that are going to read your report, but okay.
That's been the story of my PhD, Hayley, but that's a story for another day. So fear not, there are no charts in this report. The first number is a sobering number, and it's the number 10, which is the number of conflicts that the International Crisis Group suggests that we watch this year in 2024. They said at the beginning of this year that 2024 began with wars burning in Gaza, Sudan, and the Ukraine, and that peacemaking was in crisis. And they cautioned that worldwide diplomatic efforts to end fighting are failing. they say that more leaders are pursuing their ends militarily, believing that they can get away with it. So I do mention this sobering number because it links back to the motivation for this report, which is that economic tools have this role to play in deterrence and in stabilizing regions. They're just part of the toolkit, but we really need all the levers that we have. Then my second number is a brighter number, and it's the number six. I'm just opening the Unlocking Economic Security report here to page 15. So six is the number of types of flows of resources that I talk about in the report as flowing between countries today. And I mention that because the report actually has a real optimistic undertone to it, which is that there are ways that we can shape our global environment that is more competitive, that is more complex, that's moving at a faster pace. And the economic tools are one slice of that. So we have these six global resource flows that we can think cleverly and carefully about how to dial up and down the incentives that affect those flows between countries to do things like make our region more food secure or to help drive the clean energy transition for our regional partners and our allies. I do see agency here for us and our region.
Wow, Helen, those two numbers actually to me tell me how complex the situation is that we confront. 10 conflicts, six different resource flows. It shows you that we're in a more competitive, not competitive, more complex, well, competitive as well, environment. Thank you so much for speaking with me. Congratulations on your report. For anyone interested, they can visit our website, download a copy of your report. It integrates all of the best ideas and the key takeaways harvested, I'm going to say, from your PhD. So if people that don't have time to read a PhD but want all of the gold nuggets, download Helen's report. And just to wrap up, if you're interested in hearing more about this topic, our CEO, Dr. Michael Green, is a co-host of the Asia Chessboard podcast. In February, he recorded a podcast with our senior economic advisor, Dr. John Kunkel, on Australia's economic future. That's a really good episode to understand more. And also you can check out some of USSC's podcasts that are from our live events. So thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll tune in again next time.